Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Ali Sadler, and today I have the honor of being a Hinckley Forum host for a moment. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequests of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors, here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. I've also been honored to serve as the ASUU Government Relations Director for this year. The purpose of the Government Relations Board has been to connect and to also work to empower students through their relations with government. That's local, state, and national government. I look forward to the next year for government relations, and I hope that even though this is our concluding event for the year, that you'll get involved next year. And the ASUU office is in room 234 in the Union Building. I'd also like to thank the Hinckley Institute for their partnership from the Civic Engagement Conference at the beginning of the year through the presidential debate broadcast to the Legislative Preview Week. They've provided the space, the support, and the partnership to make a year's worth and more of informative and engaging political events for students. I'd now like to introduce Laura Anderson, a board member of the Government Relations Board that really got this event started. She noticed how important the sequester is for not only the nation, but for all of us as students. She brought forth this topic and brought forth the attention, so she will really be the host today. So, now to Laura.
Awesome. So, Ali introduced, we have the exciting opportunity today to discuss the sequester. My number one notice across campus was students saying, sequester, what? We fell off a cliff? I don't understand. So we gathered two professors who agreed to help us discuss further and bring our attention to what exactly the sequester is and what is happening on a national level and how it impacts us locally, predominantly through the university. So as an introduction to that subject, the sequester started... Well, the series of events started in 2011 with a debate over increasing the debt ceiling, creation of a super committee to solve that. Debt ceiling ended up being raised, and then the super committee actually collapsed, spiraling into a debate throughout 2012 of the extension of the Bush tax cuts, and then ultimately new taxes starting on January 1st of this year. And then about $85 billion across-the-board spending cuts that were introduced about a month ago. And so to help, illustrate the topic and what it means for our university, state, and nation, we have two speakers. First, we'll hear from Rick Haskell. He is a PhD candidate in the Department of Economics. He assists in management of the College and Social Behavioral Science Research and Grant Portfolio. He's a retired business owner, and he teaches labor economics, health economics, and current economic problems at the U, and he focuses his research efforts on human capital and investment and development. And secondly, we'll be hearing from James Curry. He's currently an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science. His research focuses on partisanship, leadership, and the legislative process in the United States Congress, and he received his PhD in government and politics from the University of Maryland, and he has been published in Legislative Studies Quarterly and Congress Reconsidered. And with that, I'll pass the time over to you guys.
Well, thank you, Laura. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about some of this today. I come at this from the perspective of being a human capital economist, but also working within the college's research administration unit. And from that unit, we get an opportunity to see what happens in terms of budgets and such for the university and what's going to happen in terms of the budget effect of the sequestration. So we're going to go through a number of slides here today. Some of them we'll go through very quickly. My role is to simply try to give you an understanding as to the numeric impact, the monetary, budgetary impact of the sequestration as we go through the next couple of years. You're going to see that as an exogenous event, I couldn't help but include another event that's about to take place that affects the U perhaps even more dramatically in for a very short period of time. But we'll go through and look at the sequestration, and then we'll look at specifically how it affects our budgets, how it affects what we're doing here at the U. Oh, excuse me. So this initially is just a look at the sequestration. The upper blue line shows us the spending trend for discretionary federal spending without the sequestration. And then you see in 2012, the dotted line directly underneath that shows the effect of the $110 billion discretionary spending cut. The red solid line and the green solid line, which are a little bit difficult to see separately on here, show the defense spending and the non-defense spending. And those are the two basic categories of discretionary spending, of course. We're going to talk a little bit about the direct effects of the sequestration as it affects university revenues, as well as how it affects enrollments. And then we'll also talk about indirect effects, the impact on state and local economies. And all of this is predicated on your acceptance of a Keynesian multiplier, recognizing that a dollar of additional expenditures, say, on the part of the federal government turns out to be more than a dollar of output in the economy as a whole, more than a dollar effect on GDP. And if you believe that to be the case, then you have to accept that the inverse is true as well. A dollar of spending cuts equates to more than a dollar of output changes in the negative. We'll also briefly reference the money multiplier effect, because if we have a GDP change, if we have any unemployment as a byproduct of this, then we're going to have some contraction of the money supply, just making it more difficult for the Federal Reserve to affect monetary policy. And then we'll talk lastly, but although very briefly, about the human capital impact here. So to give you an idea as to the university's budget, we're running a little over a $3 billion budget in the university right now, inclusive of every element of the university. The three most important parts of that for our consideration today are state appropriations at about 8%, tuition and fees at about 9%, and this is as of 2012, and then 13% in way of grants and contracts, most of which are federal. In fact, as we look at that, we see that of that grant and contract figure, 77% of those numbers are federal monies, but the others are affected by federal changes as well. But the 77% breaks down then as follows, the most important parts of that being about 76% of it coming out of the National Institutes of Health, which funds much of the research here on campus. And that's through the Department of Health and Human Services, 9% from the National Science Foundation. We do have 6% coming out of the Department of Energy, and then another 4% coming out of the Veterans Administration. These comprise the 13% in grants and contracts. So as we look at this, we know that we're about to face budget cuts in these areas. And when it comes to these institutions that grant funds for research monies here at the U, we know that they're about to face a 5% budget cuts for each of the next several years, or as long as this is anticipated to last for them. Jim will talk about how long that might be. So I've simply applied that 5% for the NIH, 5.1% for NSF, National Institutes of Health and National Science Foundation, applied a 12% reduction in funding from the Department of Defense. Even though it's a 20% overall reduction, the expectation in terms of their grant and awards is only going to be 12%. And then Department of Energy, since it's still a fairly significant contributor of resources to the U, have included that. That's only expected to be a 3% reduction in the next couple of years. Just as importantly, in fact, maybe more importantly, as you see some of the numbers play out, is we expect enrollment changes. We know over the last decade, as we've seen unemployment changes, that a 1% change in unemployment begets about a 200-unit change in enrollment at the U. Okay? So if we see a 1% increase in unemployment as a byproduct of sequestration, which is about what economists expect generally, then we're likely to see about 200 additional students enroll at the U. And the issue there is the opportunity cost. Many of us end up going to school because our opportunity outside of academia isn't that good during a recession or other difficult economic time. We also have an effect that, and this is the one I just couldn't stay away from because it's happening at the exact same time. The LDS mission policy change is expected to affect enrollment at the U somewhere between 410 and 820 students for each of the next 2 years. And that's of the Utah State Office of Higher Education. Well, if we cut that in half and say it's only a 600 student impact on the U and then add 200 new students, it appears as though we're going to have about a 400 student impact on the U for the next couple of years. That LDS mission change, of course, is a one-time event. It gives us a shortage very quickly, brings that all back, and then we have relative stabilization beyond that. But here's what ends up happening in terms of our revenues and budgets. The black bar, the highest of them, of course, is the overall revenue for the university. And you can see here that we breached the $3 billion mark in 2012. Which is the last of the years here that are audited and come from the university's annual report. The 2013 academic year, which we're just about to end, is not audited, but those are actual numbers and some small projections. And then the 2014 year is simply a projection based upon these variables that we've talked about. As you look here, we can see some of the change that took place as we went from 2007 and 2008. And that was the change that we experienced as a byproduct of the financial crisis and state revenues, et cetera, falling so dramatically. That ended up being a 0.22% change, so less than 0.25% change in total revenue for the university. And those of us that lived through that recognize how difficult it was to manage faculty needs, staff, student programs, and such, well enough any of the research needs and such that we have. If the projections that we have are accurate relative to the sequestration, the first year budget change is 2.2%, or 10 times the change that we experienced as a byproduct of the fiscal crisis, the financial crisis of 2006-2009. So that's a significant impact on the U. I won't even try to discuss what that means at the department levels or at the student level, because that's a function of administration. And some of that, of course, is heavily influenced by this enrollment issue. The enrollment issue, given that much of it appears to be a one-time negative and then perhaps followed by a one-time positive and then stabilization, may be such that the university uses other resources to smooth that out. I certainly don't know that. But this is assuming that there is no smoothing effect and that we face a 2.2% revenue shortfall for the 2014 academic year, which is not insignificant. I break that out a little bit further for you, just let you see state appropriations in the blue bar. Tuition and fees in the red bar, and then grants and contracts, those federal grants and contracts in the green bar. It's interesting, you can see that state appropriations rose through 2007, even 2008, and then dropped dramatically as the effect of the financial crisis hit. And I reference that because we can't separate what we're dealing with now in terms of sequestration with the financial crisis. The underpinnings of both are the same. We then see also that for the first time in the U's history in 2012, tuition and fees were greater than state appropriations. So what it means is that the households that are represented by the students at the U are paying roughly the exact same amount right now as the state is paying for our education here. So it's a quasi-public-private partnership at the moment. We go a little bit further on thinking about some of the economic impact. We have to consider where employment comes from in the state. 2% of our state workforce comes from federal employment, so federal job opportunities of different types. Fortunately, Utah has 85% private, which is higher than most states. So a federal budget cut would have less of an impact on employment here in the state than it would elsewhere. But if you deal with the Keynesian multiplier effect and then the longer-term money multiplier effect and the money supply, that certainly can't be ignored. But that 2% of the state workforce represents 18% of the GDP that comes from the state. Now, that's not 18% of state revenues in the state coffers. That's 18% of revenue created in the state of Utah. So if we think about the effects of all that, we recognize that we're about to face possibly a 2.2% budget decrease, total revenue decrease at the university. Now, that's holding constant many, many variables that could change, that could dramatically affect how this is administered through the U and how it affects each of us. But it has the ability to affect us in that kind of ratio. 2.2% doesn't sound like much, but many of us recognize very well, many of us have seen firsthand, the effect of a 2 or 3% decrease in employment, a 2 or 3% decrease in GDP, which again sounds like it's a very small number, but has a dramatic impact overall, because at the end of the day, we live at the margins. We live at the little bits of change that happen at the end of the revenue streams. So as we go a little bit further with this, my greater concern than the actual numbers themselves, even though I'm fairly numerically biased as an economist, my greater concern is what this does to human capital generally. Human capital is the investment that we make in ourselves towards productivity, towards utility and satisfaction. And we recognize that as expenditures change in education, those are directly relate to changes in income levels, and they directly relate to changes in health levels. We also know that the causation is not as clear as this would suggest. In developing economies, this causation is direct and clear. In developed economies as our own, both state and national, the causation really goes both ways. We know that higher levels of income create higher levels of health and education. Higher levels of education create higher levels of income and health, and so on. So we have to consider all of these things. And again, my role is just to point out some of the things to be thinking about today. A budget shortfall, an enrollment change, become the direct effects of this. The indirect effects have more to do with the pressure on private sector and government employment, where we're expecting to see a 1% unemployment increase, have to do with this whole money multiplier and Keynesian multiplier effect. A $110 billion cut in federal spending equates to more than a $110 billion cut in output. We recognize that output change also is then going to have some kind of a change or some kind of effect on deposits within banks. Households that are not able to support their needs based upon incomes will start to dip into other resources. And as they do that, that then reduces their reserves, that then reduces the money supply, which then helps in contracting the economy generally. And then finally, the pressure that we'll see on human capital investments, which from my perspective is the larger, longer term, and more significant issue that we're going to face. Thanks. This is Jim.
All right, well, I also want to thank ASU New Government Relations Board for inviting me, Institute for inviting me to speak today, and for Rick for a fantastic overview of the effects of the sequester going forward. The sequester is a very important issue, and I hope those of you here today, and I'm glad there's a lot of you here today, understand that. It's also a fascinating issue from a political perspective because it gives us sort of a way to sort of look into and understand the current political dynamic through a very tangible case. And so my role here today is to explain the political situation around the sequester. Why did the sequester occur? What were the political dynamics that led to it? And what are the political dynamics that result from it and that we may see down the line relating to it? And to those ends, you should understand that there are essentially three important forces about congressional action or that explain congressional action that relate to the sequester. The first of these is that, believe it or not, members of Congress act to try to please their constituents, the people that they represent. What this means is that members of Congress will support congressional action that they believe their constituents will like or that they believe will benefit their constituents, and they will oppose that kind of action that they believe their constituents will dislike or have an unfavorable reaction to or that they believe will hurt their constituents. Now, for this to work, for action to take place, that means enough members of Congress have to believe that the action being proposed is favorable to their constituents, and that specifically if it is unfavorable, they have to believe that the effects of this unfavorable action will be traced back to them. In other words, they have to believe that something negative, such as not taking action or taking an adverse action, is something that they will be punished for in the next election, that they will lose their job, they'll be thrown out of office, those sorts of things. And that's not always the case that there's this direct connection. Now, relating to that first point is the second factor, the second force that plays into this, and that is that today the members of the two parties in Congress and in Washington, D.C. in general are highly, highly polarized. They each represent very different constituencies, and they each represent different people that believe and want to see very different things happen from Congress and from the government. Regarding deficits, there is broad agreement among members of both parties that the federal deficit should be reduced. There is absolutely no agreement between the members of the two parties about how that should be done. And that makes it very difficult for compromise to be crafted to take specific action in Washington, D.C. Now, the third factor relates back to the first two again. And that is today we have divided government. We have split control of Congress, and we have a president who is of a different party than the House of Representatives. This encodes, in a way, the disagreement that is seen in the polarization of the parties, because not only is it that you have one party disagreeing with the other, but you need to, by definition today, because the House is controlled by Republicans and because the Senate is controlled by Democrats and the White House controlled by Democrats, you need the proposed congressional action to be something that members of both parties believe is something their constituents will like or something their constituents will not dislike, and something that they do not believe that they will be blamed for if they don't like it. That is very difficult. And that is without even bringing into the discussion things like the filibuster, which complicate the situation. Now, so how do these three things explain the sequester? Well, it goes all the way back to, as you heard in the beginning of the forum, the Budget Control Act, which was the bill that was passed, the law that was created to deal with the looming debt ceiling crisis in the summer of 2011. Now, at this point, just like today, there was broad agreement among members of both parties that, one, deficits should be reduced, and that, two, allowing the country to go into default by not raising the debt ceiling is probably a bad thing. Not every member of Congress believed that, but enough of them to actually pass something. However, there was no agreement because of the polarization between the two parties on exactly what specific action should be taken to achieve that, exactly how the debt ceiling should be raised, how any costs from the debt ceiling should be offset, if indeed they should be offset, and how exactly the federal government should try to reduce its deficit, because if you're going to reduce a deficit, you either have to increase revenues or you have to decrease spending or both. And then you have to decide where do you increase revenues, where do you decrease spending, or where do you do both. And there was no agreement on the specific action to do so, because members of one party believe that taking action the other party was supporting would be something their constituents would have a hostile and negative reaction to. So the compromise was essentially to pass a bill, pass the Budget Control Act, that kicked the can down the road, that said, yes, we're going to increase the debt ceiling, we're going to offset the cost of doing so, we're going to reduce the deficit, but we don't know how yet. So we're going to create a super committee that was bipartisanly created with equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans that had a few months, essentially, to come up with a very specific and detailed plan for how to do that, how to achieve specifically $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction over 10 years, and that they would report that to Congress, and Congress either accepted or rejected. The teeth to that was that, or the extra point to it was that, if the super committee failed, if Congress did not agree to a plan created by the super committee or some other plan, you would have the sequester, which would be an automatically implemented, automatic across-the-board cuts for the next 9 years that would total $1.2 trillion. The idea was that make a committee that has more time to come up with a solution because, you know, it's not as if they didn't, for some reason, April to August was not enough time, so maybe the next three months would be different. But to add to that, that if you fail, there are consequences, that you have these these blunt meat axe type cuts that are not pointed, that are not strategic in any way. But, as you all know, the super committee failed. The super committee did not even report a plan. It's not as if the super committee reported a plan and Congress couldn't agree to it. The small number of members, the six and six, the 12 total members who were on the super committee, could not agree to any sort of specific action. And again, this goes back to polarization. Anything that the Democrats wanted to do, the Republicans did not. And anything the Republicans wanted to do, the Democrats did not. They did not believe that compromising, no one member of that super committee believed that compromising and accepting the ideas of the other side would be less problematic for them and less problematic for their constituents than doing nothing at that point. And that's in part because they didn't believe their constituents would think so, but also because the consequence of doing nothing to them at that time was very remote. The threat of the sequester was very remote. It was 13 months away in November of 2011, And they figured, well, if we can't do it now, we have 13 months to figure out another plan. So the super committee failed. Congress did not pass any sort of deficit reduction bill in December of 2011, and we move on. The other reason the super committee did not come to an agreement, did not report a plan, is because with a completely bipartisan committee with exactly the same number of Democrats and Republicans, neither side believed that they would necessarily be blamed for the failure of it. Who do you blame when a bipartisan committee fails? Do you blame the Democrats? Do you blame the Republicans? They're both accountable. No one side was clearly accountable. People's reactions to the failure of the super committee would ultimately come down to their own partisanship. If you're a Democrat, you probably blame the Republicans for not compromising. Why didn't they accept some sort of revenue increases? If you're a Republican, you probably blame the Democrats. Why didn't they accept some sort of entitlement reform? We need to reform our entitlements. And so it was not an automatic, clear result for them that their party would take the blame, they would be hurt in the election, and so on and so forth. So that's over with, and it's 13 months later, and then eventually into March before the sequester would actually hit because of other policies that were passed. But the next question is, why then did the sequester ultimately come into place? Why didn't Congress ultimately, by the beginning of March of this year, come up with a plan to replace it with something that was probably less damaging, less indiscriminate, whatever? Because the point of the sequester, the reason it was placed in the Budget Control Act, was to replace or to change the dynamics that were created by the three factors that I mentioned at the start of wanting to please constituents, of party polarization, of divided government. The idea was that if you put this ultimate consequence at the end of the road, it would make it so that compromise would seem preferable to the sequester. Well, obviously it wasn't, because we did have to implement the sequester. We did reach that deadline. So why? Essentially, there are two flaws to the actual sequester policy that did not allow it to actually change the dynamics at all. The first of these is that the consequences to each party, to a majority of members of Congress, did not appear severe enough. Now, we just heard an excellent presentation about why the consequences of the sequester certainly are significant, but to members of Congress, they did not appear severe enough to either side. The cuts appeared too shallow to most members of Congress. You heard a lot of derision during the last debate in February about how it's only a 3% cut. If we can't handle a 3% cut to the federal budget, then we have a problem, things like that. Also, Democrats specifically were not as necessarily motivated to remove the sequester because their most important policy priorities, the entitlement programs, are largely untouched. There's a small cut this year, a 2% cut to Medicare, and every other entitlement program is unaffected. So they're largely able to keep what they wanted. And Republicans did not believe that the cuts were drastic enough to really be damaging, at least to them, politically, if not to the economy as a whole. And ultimately, they believed that going through the sequester for them and for what they believed the reaction of their constituents would be preferable to either if a Republican, you're a Republican compromising on taxes, or if you're a Democrat compromising on entitlement reform. So nothing happened. Now, on top of that, the sequester, the other flaw with the sequester, is did not change the accountability problem. By putting it into 2013, they kind of hoped that would take care of itself. Each side thought that they were going to win overwhelmingly the election of 2012, that they would have complete control of the government, and that changes the accountability idea, because if you have the reins of government, people know who to blame when things go wrong. If Republicans were completely in control of government at the beginning of March, or if Democrats were, the public would know who to blame if the sequester went into place. But divided government persisted after the 2012 election. And so the idea of who do you blame for the sequester, other than saying everybody, which essentially means no change from before because everyone already hates Congress, is that there is no change, that there is no automatic blame, and that the two sides could fight out who was going to take the blame in the media, on the campaign trail, et cetera, after the fact. So that's somewhat depressing. But the last question is sort of, should we see this dynamic continue, or should we expect things to change going forward? Because now the sequester is in place. Presumably people will start to feel any effects of it going forward. And I'm here to tell you that largely, we should not expect much to change, at least any time soon. Largely what we've seen over the last 2+ years in congressional action in Washington, D.C., federal action, is that nothing happens right now unless there is a very severe, ultimate, clear deadline with severe consequences for the government and for the country. The major things that happened during the 112th Congress, the previous Congress, were that they avoided a government shutdown in April of 2011 that would have been drastically damaging for the country and the economy, just barely. They avoided the debt ceiling not being raised and our country defaulting on our loans, which would have been damaging and drastic. And they avoided letting student loan rates increase or double, essentially, in the summer of 2012, just barely, about 2 days before it would have happened. Those things were seen as potentially damaging enough. The sequester for at least the next year, nothing changes, just on that alone. So then what exactly could cause Congress to act, cause Washington to act and try to create some sort of better plan to deal with the deficit problem? One, we should expect change if, for example, there's another debt ceiling crisis. If we reach the next debt ceiling limit and the Republican Party determines again that they're going to hold that hostage to get some sort of policy concessions, you may see another shot at trying to reorganize the deficit problem. Because again, that's a really drastic, obvious consequence. And so you may see another attempt that maybe gets rid of the sequester and places it with something else, or who knows. What else could lead Congress to finally act, and this may be the most depressing, is as the sequester ratchets up year after year, because the sequester ultimately continues to cut spending caps or reduce spending caps each fiscal year after this year through 2021. And the cuts get deeper each year in a lot of areas, and they pile on top of each other. You end up getting millions and millions and millions cut from Medicare in the end, from defense spending. Defense spending gets decreased quite a bit by the end of the 9 years. So at some point between now and 2021, you may find that Congress, that the president agrees that this is getting severe enough to take action. And the last thing that could cause change is if in some election coming up, one party is given control of the government, is given control of the presidency, the House, and clear control of the Senate, which in and of itself is a problem. If that occurs, the idea of accountability may change, where everybody looks to that one party to provide a solution, and they may be under enough pressure to do something rather than nothing. So the political dynamics today, what members of Congress, why they act, the polarization, the disagreement, the split control, set it up perfectly for something like this to happen that ultimately probably is not good for the country. And unless things change down the line, we should not exactly expect that this situation will just go away. So, thank you.
Awesome. That was great. Thank you so much. So now we're going to open up to some Q&A for you guys, some follow-up questions after these great presentations. So you want me to just take the microphone around? Yeah. Fantastic. So, yeah, if you have a question, just feel free to, like, raise your hand, and we'll just bring over the microphone, and we'll do that until about 2:50, and then leave you guys a few minutes for wrap-up and concluding thoughts.
Hi, I'm TJ Ellerbeck. I'm a senior in political science at the U. You talked about how the sequester happened because both parties felt like they wouldn't be viewed as being at fault, but will this have political effects on one party more than the other?
It's hard to say right now. Currently, I don't think either party has taken the brunt of the blame. I think the reaction largely to something like this and the reaction that's been so far is that if you are a Democrat in the public or if you like the Democratic Party more than you like the Republican Party, you probably blame Republicans for what happened. Why didn't they compromise? If you're a Republican, you probably blame the Democrats. People tend to view compromise in this country as the other side giving in, not both sides giving in. And so ultimately, without one clear party to blame, because both were involved in this, it's really just members of each party blaming each other. And indeed, most independents who actually lean towards one party or the other blaming one party or the other. And you end up getting a country that's split on who to blame as well.
Hello, I'm Satine. I'm a political science major here at the U and also pre-med. My question for you is, this country's been divided before on multiple occasions in recent history and far back. Have we ever experienced this sort of financial divide, maybe not something like a sequester before? Like, what are the negative effects of these divides in our history as opposed to the sequester now?
We have certainly had this kind of polarization before, and you always had these very sharp political battles over it. Now, I would say we haven't necessarily had this kind of automatic sequester type thing happen. We've had sequester policies before. We had a sequester policy in the 1980s, the Graham-Rudman-Hollings bill in 1985 that was supposed to produce deficit reduction. The difference there was that the sequestration cuts were far more sharp and dramatic than they were now. It was very far deeper cuts, bigger percent of federal spending. What Congress did then, and Congress and the president did then, was essentially they just ignored it because the cuts were so dramatically bad that they just passed a bill every year just saying, no, we're not going to do that. And so in another time when we still had somewhat of polarization in the 1980s, so not as bad, but we also had this kind of divided government, you had the same kind of solution trotted out and it didn't work, which what makes this whole situation frustrating from a political perspective is that they all know this didn't work. A lot of them were there then when it didn't work, and they tried it again, and then they're surprised it didn't work. So I hope that, hopefully that answers your question.
We've also had situations in which political ideology has brought about decreases in output or revenue and leading to some level of recession or perhaps worse. And typically, as a byproduct of that, the people get frustrated enough because we feel those cuts, those effects in our lives, that in the next election cycles that we find, we try to change the ideology. We try to change those people that are being stuck in their ideological positions.
My name is Aaron Young. I'm a mining engineering student. And my question is the dollar gonna fail and then the U.S. go bankrupt and then it will stop being the world's currency?
I wanted you to handle that. not a chance. At the most difficult economic crisis we've seen in recent generations, where the common talk was that the dollar was becoming weak, it should be replaced as the world's currency, the world sent their gold or their excess resources here because we were the safest place on Earth, literally. We have a long way to go before the U.S. loses its economic or political hegemony. And don't get me wrong, we probably reduced it somewhat over time. But when things get really, really bad the world over, resources come here, period.
Hey, I'm Joe. I'm a business student. And I just wanted to know, like, with this kind of sequester situation, like the polarization, will that like reduce into a establishment of a third party that we might see a rise in? And in such a hypothetical scenario, would a third party solve the polarization, or would it become kind of like a battle for like the tiebreaker?
No and no. Third parties in this country tend to arise when both parties are ignoring an issue, not when they're battling over it. So the best example is with slavery in the Civil War. You had the Whigs and you had the Democrats, and both of them just kind of wanted to not do anything about slavery. So the Republican Party essentially wedged in there and said, our party is all about this issue. And they were able to sweep into office, and obviously the consequences were very drastic, and things evolved from there. Now we have an issue that both parties are clearly very active and engaged on, and they represent sort of the two camps in public opinion about it. In that instance, there's not much room. There's probably maybe 10% of the public that would be satisfied with a third option rather than actually one of the other options, and that's not going to be enough to establish a true third party. Even if you had a candidate run, even someone very viable like Bloomberg, I can't imagine him getting more than 10, 15% of a vote, much less coordinating some sort of change to congressional majorities through a third party.
My name is Kaylin Ebner. I'm a sociology student as well as a Air Force ROTC cadet commissioning next year.
and going on active duty. And I just have a question on with defense cut spending, because we've already personally have felt it, actually the day after the sequestration has come in. It's about 21% cuts in ROTC funds as of right now, as well as our ground troops being grounded and our flying squadrons, a bunch of them are being grounded right now. Do you think that for our government to, especially Congress, to work together to get away from these ideologies, is that we're going to have to go to something like a huge hit in our defense, or into for each side, each party to kind of like sit back and be like, oh, wait, I have to compromise? Do you think that when the compromise is going to come, it's going to be an excruciatingly bad situation happen for change to come? And what do you personally think about that?
I do think a very likely way that this changes is with something obviously excruciatingly bad. Not necessarily a huge defense crisis, but something where enough members of both parties say, this is worse than inaction, whatever that is. But at the same time, I don't know, maybe I'm somewhat of an optimist. Those of you who have taken my classes can decide that. I think eventually there will be a compromise. And it will be something that frustratingly looks exactly like the proposals by the two bipartisan commissions from 2011, the Simpsons, Bowles, and the other one, and I forget what the names on the other ones, where it's one-third tax increases, two-thirds sort of more targeted spending cuts, I think is the ultimate consequence. But frustratingly, I don't think it'll actually come about until someone feels the pinch. And defense itself has felt a tight pinch, will feel a tighter pinch. I think it's about a 10% cut every year, which is drastic. But someone in Congress or enough people in the political system need to feel the effects of that on their constituents.
What we've left off the table here so far is the other side of the sequestration issue. There's $110 billion of budget cut, right, from discretionary spending. I think there was $150 billion of tax increase. And so this is a relevant issue as well. So we tend to motivate change by pursuing pleasure or fleeing from pain. So think about $110 billion of cuts, $150 billion of taxes, which become cuts to the household and firm or producer level. Pain follows relatively quickly.
Yeah, and then another 110 each year.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Will that pain be hyperinflation?
You might suppose, and I'm going a little afield here, you might suppose perhaps the opposite. Inflation would be the result of us having more resources chasing a stagnant or a static amount of goods. We are going to have fewer resources. And so the greater concern is that this takes us back to a recessionary state. And the recession that we've just come out of, or are coming out of, really, took us so close to a deflationary state that it was frightening. And deflation, for all intent and purposes, is going to equate to depression. So I would think perhaps just the opposite. You may be a little above my pay grade at the moment, though.
Well, that's why I was wondering why they made this decision now, when we're just slowly but surely recovering.
Because they didn't make a decision. Yeah. They decided not to decide. It's a lack of moral fortitude.
The sequester was never supposed to be the policy. It was supposed to be a threat or a deterrent to force them to come up with a better policy, to force them to target where the cuts are, to target where the revenue increases are, to have a responsible way to reduce the deficit. Whether or not it was even appropriate to do that at the time is another question, but it was never meant to be this way. This was something that wasn't in anyone's mind supposed to happen. It was supposed to force it to happen, but it didn't work.
My name is Sean Harris, and I'm an information systems major and political science. My question would be, I've noticed that the cuts are kind of like a meat cleaver instead of a scalpel. And what, I guess my question would be, as I look through the sequester, I noticed that the military gets hit hard in defense spending, but the contractors didn't take a huge hit, like the operational side of the military did. So what effect did lobbyists have in actually setting the policy for the sequestration that ended up going into effect?
Well, they will have lobbying and interest groups and pressure will have an effect on where the hits go. Now, you say that there's been no effect on contractors. There's been no effect on contractors yet because they can't renege on existing contracts. There won't be new contracts when those contracts are up. So it's something they cannot affect immediately. The cuts, the effective cuts from the sequester will appear over time. And defense contractors, I think, will be someone who will take a huge hit down the line.
And my guess is that lobbying efforts have less to do with how the blunt part of this takes place and maybe more to do with how the strategic or surgical part will take place. Remember that a 20% cut in any federal budget category is the blunt part, but you still have administrators that have to decide how does that get executed amongst our agency.
And there's a great number of accounts that are exempt from the sequester. There are a lot of things that can't be touched, like most of Veterans Affairs can't be touched, though employees, civilian employees of Veterans Affairs can be cut, and they will take most of the blunt cuts there. Well, they'll be there. There'll be attrition to the size of Veterans Affairs staff, which certainly is not good for veterans, and there will be sort of cuts to their pay and cuts to how much they can actually work to assist veterans.
One of the exempt areas that's important to many of us is the Pell Grant program, from which many of our students are dependent, is exempt from this. The Stafford Loan Program, the only change that it sees is a $3 per semester processing fee change, so an insignificant change. So the funding at the student level is, fortunately, is one of the exempt issues as well.
And this will probably...
I have another question. I heard that a lot of the student loans are going from being subsidized to unsubsidized. I think that already happened. Is that in any relation to that is sequestration cuts, right?
I'm unaware.
I think that's a separate issue. I don't think we can completely separate these things because their exogenous influences happening at the same point in time or relatively the same point in time. So I don't think we can completely separate them, but we can't also completely connect them. The issue of subsidization versus not is simply an issue, as you guys probably well understand, an issue of interest rates and what is forgiven while you're in school versus what's not. Certainly it has an impact on us long term, but in terms of what we're going to pay out in terms of interest and student loan payments. But in terms of the next 4 to 8 years, insignificant differences.
So I'm going to snag the last question. Anyway, so now that these are already in place and we have this budget coming up for the next couple of years, do either of you have a solution or what you would recommend or would like to see to help kind of offset the sequester? Or is there anything that could be done within the public or private sector to kind of lessen the blow of these cuts, if you will?
So, you know, I'll go first, and then I think Jim has some important things to say there as well. So I think we have to stop and think about for a moment why sequestration or some type of austerity program has been selected. We're at a point in time when austerity is kind of a buzzword. It's buzzing around Europe, obviously. And it's buzzing around Europe largely because in order for a European nation to stay as an active part of the EU, but change their fiscal policy, they have one of two choices, raise taxes or decrease spending. They can't shift into a big budget deficit issue like we can, or surplus, because of their agreements with the EU. So it's common and popular there, and like it or not, we still take, certainly on social issues, we still take a lot of our cue from Europe, just as the nation takes a lot of its cue from California when it comes to popular trends and such. We take a lot of our cue from Europe still on social issues. Well, this can't be separated from a social issue. And so austerity has become kind of popular. Sequestration is a bit of a byproduct of that. What ultimately happens is at a point we get fed up because we have seen our elected representatives choose to manage by inaction. And my guess is none of us went to the ballot box hoping for that to be the outcome. The salaries that are paid, the monies that are spent from your pockets and mine, we don't intend that to result in inaction. Certainly not inaction that can be crippling as this can because of an oh well.
I agree with that largely. I don't think anybody largely went to the polls for this to happen, though I think much like members of Congress, if each of you were pressed on the specifics of the cuts, you would find that you are largely opposed one way or the other to a lot of the compromises from your own sort of convictions. And that's where the problem lies. Ultimately, what I would like to see happen, what needs to happen long run for the good of the country and a public policy standpoint, is that sequester needs to be replaced with some sort of long-term deficit reduction plan. I tend to agree with the head of the Congressional Budget Office that the appropriate response fiscally to the current problem is initially something to stimulate economic recovery, but something that is immediately followed by a smart and intelligent deficit reduction plan, and something that probably looks more like the Simpson-Bowles Commission report, where you have a mixture of revenues and a mixture of cuts, but those cuts are something that are effective. The worst part of the sequester is that in the long run, it'll make almost no difference to our deficits because it does nothing about entitlement spending, which will continue to grow. Something ultimately has to be done to curb the growth of entitlement spending in an intelligent way that doesn't hurt people but allows the government to be on some sort of sound fiscal standing in 100 years. And that's, I don't know exactly how that will come about, but I think it will ultimately come about when somebody, when one side feels enough pressure, that compromise can occur.
Hey, fantastic. So we'll just dedicate a few moments for each of you to give a summary of, or any last feedback you'd like to give, just a few moments, and then we'll conclude with the forum.
So from my standpoint, even though we talk about some fairly small percentages, 2% change in that, 0.2% change in the other, and those seem insignificant. I mean, if you had a 2% change in the price of a soda at the local convenience store, you don't even notice it, right? But a 2% change in the U's budget that exceeds $3.2 billion, or even a 0.22% change in that budget, is not insignificant. The department chair or the college dean that has to administer their portion of that has tough decisions to make. And like it or not, those decisions affect our education. It affects our faculty, affects our staff, it affects our programs, it affects the resources of the university, affects the opportunity to put on events like this. And those simply change what we pick up in our educational experience. It's that change that concerns me more than anything else. Because what we pick up in that experience is what we then utilize for the next 40 or 60 years of your careers to affect your income, your utility, your level of health, what you then pass on to your next generation. That's the change that I'm concerned about.
I guess I'd just like to wrap up by encouraging each of you to learn more about this issue in general. Go and read what's out there about the sequester. There are a lot of sort of bipartisan groups and commissions that tried to do studies of the effect of this in national level, about have proposals for what should change. Educate yourself about what that is. Educate yourself about what alternatives to this are. And use that when you are getting involved in politics, when you're voting, when you're doing whatever else, because this is a severely important issue.
Right. Awesome. Thank you so much. I'd just love to echo Professor Curry's sentiment of please get involved, get engaged, contact your local representatives on a national and state level. I really hope that that's what this forum kind of drove you all to do, is intro you all in being more engaged. But please join me in thanking these two professors for their time. It was a very lovely and informative forum. So thank you.
I appreciate your comments.
No, I thought that was great in the numbers of what the effect of this is.